Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Dr. Mark Smith, President of the California Healthcare Foundation. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org and the foundation at chcf.org. This program is underwritten by the California Healthcare Foundation. It is my distinct pleasure and honor to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Donald Berwick, Administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS. At CMS, Dr. Berwick oversees the Medicare, Medicaid, and Children's Health Insurance programs. Together, these programs provide care to nearly one in three Americans. Before assuming leadership of CMS, Dr. Berwick was President and Chief Executive Officer of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement and was a distinguished academic pediatrician. He's had a distinguished and productive career in academia. The conversation and Q&A with Dr. Berwick after his prepared remarks will be moderated by Sarah Varney, who covers health for KQED's statewide news programs, The California Report, and Health Dialogues. Before I bring Dr. Berwick up, I have to say two things about him. The first is that it's really hard to overstate the level of excitement in the world of healthcare at the news of his nomination, mainly because Don Berwick had gone beyond the important but familiar role in academia of documenting flaws and problems and had actually turned his career to trying to fix them. The second thing that's remarkable about him is his gift for stories. I predict that he will tell you at least one tonight. I have heard them over the years involving such varied circumstances as his left knee, his wife's care, and how his physician father would react to today's healthcare system. And so, without further ado, addressing the topic, Modernizing Medicare and Medicaid, How to Upgrade America's Healthcare System, please welcome Dr. Don Berwick.
Thank you so much, Mark. It was easy to accept Mark's invitation to join you, and I feel very privileged to get to share thoughts with you here at this distinguished site, the Commonwealth Club, which I understand is the oldest and largest public affairs forum in the United States. It's a great privilege to be here, and all especially to acknowledge my longstanding friendship with and admiration for Mark, what a great leader our country has in Mark and all he's contributed through the years. I thought I'd spend my time with you this evening sharing some thoughts about the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, where I work now. I'll give you a little bit of a sense of the scene that I find myself in now, and then talk a bit about the possibilities that I think are out there for helping our country find the kind of health care that we're all really searching for. This is my fifth month at CMS. I think today is my fifth month day. I'm 5 months old, and I'm learning the ropes there. I'm privileged to deal with an extraordinarily talented group of colleagues there, 4,500 of them, who work really every day to trying to make things as good as they possibly could be for the 100 million beneficiaries that depend on us to do our work well and to protect the future as well, so that we can be sure that Medicare and Medicaid and CHIP and the other investments we have in the health of our public will be there as long as we want. It's a thrilling place to be and a thrilling time right now. Very challenging, but it's as interesting as any position I've had the privilege of occupying in my career. CMS feels to me day to day like sort of three organizations at once that I'll explain to you. The first is a large insurance company. It's the largest insurer in our country. And is responsible for making sure that the flow of supports for 100 million people occur through the programs that we administer. It's awe-inspiring to watch that organization do that work. The dedication of the staff, the sense of professionalism around that core function impresses me every single day. The second component of CMS right now has to do with this new legislation we have, the Affordable Care Act, clearly a landmark piece of legislation, the most important legislation in healthcare in our time since Medicare and Medicaid themselves were founded. CMS has a big role in translating that law into rules and regulation and real activity, implementing the law, and that's taking a lot of energy. We're doing a lot of work every day to create the rule base and the processes that allow that extremely important piece of legislation to become a reality. I guess what I'm bringing to CMS, not against any resistance, and it's not by any means totally new there, is the third organization, the third role, and it has to do with the improvement of care in our nation. Shortly after I arrived, I proposed a kind of rubric for my time there and the image that I would like to have of CMS. And that rubric is the following, that we will be and are a major force and a trustworthy partner for the continual improvement of health and health care for all Americans. That's a carefully worded idea. A major force imagines an organization that's proactive, reaching out, reaching into the future, not just accepting things as they are, but helping things get better. A trustworthy partner is key. It is more and more evident to me that no single organization in our country, government, private, or public, not CMS, can do the job we need to do to help America reach the healthcare system that we all want. It has to be done together. There's no other way. And we have to be the best possible partner across all the boundaries that we have, getting all the stakeholders in the healthcare system together. And I'll talk a little more about the assets we have to do that in a few more minutes. A major force and a trustworthy partner for the continual improvement. And that's important also. It's all too easy, especially in a stressed status quo, to check the box, good enough, made the grade, no problem. That's not what American healthcare needs right now. We need a different attitude, and that's an attitude of continual improvement, never done, never finished. No matter where you're performing or what you're doing, you can be better. And I'm very interested in helping that organization, as we all are, I think, need to be oriented toward the continual improvement of care for Americans, no matter where we start. A major force and a trustworthy partner for the continual improvement of health and healthcare. That's important also. Healthcare is the obvious job because we fund and support the delivery of care. But if you actually work from the science we have, the epidemiology of illness, you know as well as I do that the access to what we really want, vital lives, long lives, healthy lives, isn't really achieved through the healthcare system except in small measure. Only 10% of the variation in health status can be achieved through healthcare. The other 90% depends on some things we can't control, like genetics, but a lot of things we can: behavioral choices, risk factors in our environment, social and economic disparities, the generators of ill health, the choices we make and can make differently to be healthier. I'm interested in a CMS that is interested in health as well as healthcare, and we're thinking very hard in the leadership team and with all the components that I get to work with now around how to help a healthy society emerge that turns to healthcare only as the last resort. When the health-giving properties of our communities and our choices have been exhausted. The continual improvement of health and healthcare for all Americans, and that's just a statement of fact. My job, what I wake up every morning now thinking about, is the well-being of a particularly vulnerable and important subgroup of our country, the 100 million beneficiaries in Medicare, Medicaid, and CHIP. That's top of my mind. But I know that to navigate our country together toward the healthcare system we want and need, it would be foolish to pretend that we could shape healthcare on behalf of 100 million of our neighbors and not do it for all of us. It's the whole system in play, and that's another realm of partnership. We've got to be partners with all of us, with all of those stakeholders who are responsible for thinking about all of the other components of American society. There's been no resistance at all to this, and I'm thrilled and honored by the receptivity in, among my colleagues in CMS for that vision, a force for improvement of care for all of us. And I'm equally thrilled by the sense of partnership. I can't tell you the number of organizations that have shown up in my office in these 5 months, all with a question or a request. They all want something, of course. They care about what they do. But what they also bring is generosity. And the most common question that occurs in my office today is, how can I help you? And it doesn't matter who's there, whether it's the employer or payer community, the caregiving community, the professional societies, consumer groups, whoever shows up seems to sense this is an important time in America to get together and do what's right for our people. Now, the trampoline for that is this new legislation, the Affordable Care Act. It's a landmark piece of legislation. The more I know it, the more respect I have for it. It's an extraordinary piece of public policy. The Affordable Care Act is full of answers. It answers the needs of a lot of us and our neighbors, 32 million people who one way or another through that Affordable Care Act will find health care coverage that wouldn't have had it otherwise. That's an answer to them. It's an answer to people with chronic illness in our country who much too often have been told by their insurer that they're not insurable because they need care. How paradoxical is that? The Affordable Care Act changes that. Over time now, the requirement will be that all people can have access to coverage. An answer to young people under 26 who are now covered by their parents' policies and who otherwise would find themselves floating in that time as they find their legs into the mature life that lies ahead of them. It helps small businesses through subsidies. It helps people at the margins of low income find their way toward insurance, millions of people. It's an answer for our country. Providing a form of security to so many more of us so that we cannot have to wake up in the morning wondering if we will have the access to the health care coverage that we want. We won't wake up worried that we'll be bankrupted by health care costs. But along with that set of answers comes a question, what I regard as the key question in the Affordable Care Act with respect to the future, and that is, all right, we have better coverage, more guarantees. You can get the care that you want and need. But what care? Coverage of what? Of what system? It feels a little bit like this to me, that there's sort of almost two phases to this tectonic change in our stewardship of the healthcare system. Phase one is this phase of making sure people can get the coverage and care they need, well underway now and exciting to be able to implement. But the second phase, and the one we have to be in with equal and even more dedication, has to do with shaping the care system that's sustainable. Because what we know is that the American healthcare system as it currently functions is not sustainable. It wouldn't have been sustainable even if we didn't provide the expanded coverage on the Affordable Care Act. This raises the stakes because so many more people now have access to care. It's not sustainable because of its fragmentation, its separateness, the fact that we build a healthcare system that exists in pieces instead of as an entirety. It exists in events instead of journeys. And what we know from science and from our own experience is that that's not what we need, certainly not those of us with chronic illness or ongoing needs who are making a journey through their lives, meeting our healthcare world at different points in time, but who for whom fragmentation is a toxic, erosive property. A sustainable healthcare system has to make sense to the people who need it. And today our system too often does not. We have a long and distinguished intellectual tradition in our country that helps us understand the nature of the gap. It was really given its most important punctuation in 2001 by a very important Institute of Medicine report that I'm sure most of you know called Crossing the Quality Chasm. The Institute of Medicine committee that did that review of thousands of journal papers and hundreds of books to come to its conclusion stated the following that gave the report its title: between the healthcare we have and the healthcare we could have lies not just a gap, but a chasm. That's a rather dramatic statement by a rather conservative body, the National Academy of Sciences. It was backed up by extensive evidence, and it was given further texture through the definition of the dimensions of that chasm, the dimensions of the quality problem. Six dimensions in particular were called out. They are these: safety. The finding was that too many people get injured in care today. Tens of thousands of people die from complications of healthcare that are avoidable. So safety was the first of the six dimensions outlined in that report. The second was effectiveness. That refers to the promise that Americans could have that they will get all of the care that can help them, that we can match what happens to the patient to what the science says can help the patient. And by the way, not subject people to the risks and costs and burden of care that can't help them. It's a plea for alignment between what we do and what can help, effectiveness. The third was patient-centeredness. That has to do with who's the boss. The Institute of Medicine's findings about quality, place patient-centeredness, person-centeredness at the core of the definition of quality itself. We are, as I often have said, guests in the patient's lives, not hosts in our organizations. And that implies forms of choice and empowerment and self-esteem and dignity and control in the hands of patients and families and communities to which the healthcare system defers. We serve them. We don't command them. The fourth dimension is timeliness. In all modern industries, all modern sectors, delay, unwanted delay, is waste. And the Institute of Medicine called for a reduction of that form of defect, a reduction of unwanted delays and waits. The fifth dimension was efficiency. That's the reduction of waste in other forms. Follow a nurse through her day and watch her waste her time, because we make her do so in meaningless tasks and in hunter-gatherer activities and disorganized systems, making up for the fragmentation itself. The amount of waste of effort in American healthcare is enormous, and it helps no patient whatsoever. It hurts them because that expended energy is eroding time and attention. And the sixth dimension was equity. Probably should have been listed first. It had to do with the ongoing American problem of racial and socioeconomic gaps in health status, access, and the outcomes of care. And those six dimensions, safe, effective, patient-centered, timely, efficient, and equitable care, represent the findings of the Institute of Medicine report on the nature of the chasm. But that was not a pessimistic report. It was an optimistic one because it proposed we can close the chasm. Its diagnostic sentence was something like this. It was, in its current form, habits, and environment, the American healthcare system is incapable of meeting the needs of those it serves. Incapable. That's an optimistic sentence because it implies that a different system could. And that goes to the root of the field I've been in for decades, the field of improvement, in which the core idea is that if you don't like the performance of the system you have, you can change it through systematic effort. If you don't like your tennis game, change your stroke. If you don't like the way things are going with your significant other, talk about it. That investment in improvement is investment in change. And the Institute of Medicine report outlined the dimensions that we could begin to explore as a country to get healthcare reconfigured into the form that it needs to be. In the work I used to do and the organization that I left to come to CMS, we always had a rubric. It was, every system is perfectly designed to achieve exactly the results it gets. Every system is perfectly designed to achieve exactly the results it gets. I used to teach this in the university to students by talking about my own daughter, Rebecca, who is now something either 23 or 24 years old. I think 24. I used to describe a long hike my family took with Rebecca when she was 5 years old down a mountainside and up and down a mountain in the Rockies, a 16-mile hike, which means I should have been reported to some child protection. This is a true story. We were coming down late at night, and Becca was going much too slow. We were going to get to the car in the dark, so I started saying, there are lions and tigers and bears here. Please move quickly. And she didn't, so I started yelling at her, as a good father would, and she started crying, as a good child would. So I yelled at her, she cried. I yelled at her, she cried. And I yelled at her, and she vomited. And then finally, Becca turned around, looked at me, and put her hands on her hips, and she said, Daddy, telling me to walk faster does not make me able to walk faster. The guru of improvement. In Africa, they used to say, weighing a pig does not make the pig fatter. If you don't like the findings, safety, effectiveness, patient-centeredness, timely efficiency, and equity, get a new system. Find the way that it works better. And the optimism that I feel every day is the optimism to know that it's being done every day. All over our country, there are organizations, hospitals, clinics, physicians, nurses who are finding better ways to do things. We have a tremendous amount of imagination in this country able to find the way to walk faster. And it is through change. All improvement is change. Not all change is improvement, but all improvement is change. That's the second question the Affordable Care Act gives us. It's phase two. Will we change? Are we willing to have American healthcare become what it can be through change? It's the only way. As I think about the future in CMS, I I try to always return to thinking of a patient. Mark warned you about stories, but I have one. I actually told it years ago, because it happened years ago. I was an attending physician in a children's hospital. And it was my habit when I taught the residents and medical students there to go to a patient with them and ask about improvement, to generally say what could be better. It was a kind of routine I followed. And one particular encounter still sticks with me. It's vivid in my mind. We went to the bedside of a 15-year-old boy. His name was Kevin. And I said to Kevin, with the residents and medical students there, Kevin, you know this place pretty well. He knew it very well. Kevin had short bowel syndrome, a very serious chronic illness coming from surgery as an infant. And he had been in the hospital, I don't know, perhaps 30 times in his 15-year-old life. I said, Kevin, you're pretty expert here. You've seen a lot. We want to improve. What could be better? And Kevin said, nothing. It's fine. You're great. I said, no, okay, Kevin, I know we're great. What could be better? He said, I told you, you're fine. I said, Kevin, I want three ideas. Tell me what could be better. He said, well, okay. And he wrote down on a piece of paper three things that have stuck in my mind ever since. Here's what Kevin said. First, he said, please tell me what you're going to do before you do it to me. Kevin wanted a plan. He didn't want to be buffeted. He wanted to understand that there was an underlying journey being played out for him and with him, in which anticipation and prediction and foreknowledge was part of the game. Tell me what you're going to do before you do it to me, please. The second thing Kevin said was something like this. I have 15 or 20 doctors, I don't know how many nurses, technicians and therapists all the time. He said, would you please talk to each other? That's what he wrote on the piece of paper, talk to each other. Kevin wants us to be a team. He wanted us to knit together the story of his care and the fragmentation. And the last thing Kevin said was this. He said, you know, I know a lot. I've been here more than you have. He said, could you please ask me what I think? Maybe I could help. He knew that he could be part of the system, and that his individuality and his particular needs and his particular knowledge were one of the greatest assets we possibly had in our effort to help him, let alone him help himself. Tell me what you're going to do before you do it to me. Talk to each other, please. And ask me what I think. Kevin could have written the Affordable Care Act. Because he can envision in his simple words, as a wise 15-year-old consultant, what seamless, coordinated, integrated, meaningful care really, really is. Kevin had in his simple ideas the solution to the American healthcare problem. Be a system. Work together. Do this all together. Talk to each other. Make a plan. And give me, the patient, all the rights and responsibilities and authority and dignity that I deserve. Now, we give that other names in the technical world of improvement, healthcare delivery, legislation. I've talked for years about the three-part aim that I've now proposed become the rubric for the achievements of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, a major force for the continual improvement of health and healthcare for all Americans. What do I mean by improvement? I mean three things. Thing one is, back to that IOM report, better care if I'm sick, better care for Kevin when he's in a bed, better care for individuals, safe, effective, patient-centered, timely, efficient, equitable care. That's not an unfair request, and it's not out of reach. It is not yet achieved. In the New England Journal of Medicine, barely a month ago, is a report from the state of North Carolina by Chris Landrigan and his team tracking 10 hospitals in North Carolina between 2002 and 2007 to study their all-cause injuries to patients. This is the harm part. This is the safety part. People get hurt in hospitals. They have infections they shouldn't get. They have pressure ulcers that can be avoided. I visit a senior center this morning with zero pressure ulcers. That can be achieved. We're not there. We're not there. And better care for individuals would mean a vast social commitment in this country to make healthcare as safe as it possibly can be, which is much, much safer than it is today. And you can take each of those dimensions, effectiveness, guaranteeing the right care every single time to every single person in this country, the kind of reliability we expect in our automobile or our hotel, We have a right to expect the same in our healthcare world. Patient-centeredness, the dignity that Kevin wants to be able to be honored as an individual with respect to what he knows and can contribute. Timeliness, efficiency, equity. We can do far better, but we're not there yet. Better care for individuals. But that's only one aim. The second aim has to be about the things that bring us into the hospital in the first place. Kevin's illness is of no fault of his own. But our heart attacks, our strokes, consequences of substance abuse, the unwise choices we make lead to the need for care in the first place, and we can do a ton about that. An enormous portion of the illnesses that erode our opportunities in life come from things that we could control if we choose to. Now, we have given lip service to prevention in this country ever since the word prevention was invented, but we have not invested in it, not at the level that we could. The Affordable Care Act improves that. We have now, under Medicare coverage for the first time, well adult visits for every single Medicare beneficiary at no cost to them every single year. We now cover it, we'll be covering it, no copayment or deductible, colonoscopies and mammographies, forms of prevention that are graded as effective by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. So we are investing more in prevention, but we could get much more serious about it and as a country deal with the stunning epidemic of obesity that's almost bone-chilling to study as you look at the maps produced by CDC about the spreading obesity epidemic. We could save 1 million hearts a year, according to the Centers for Disease Control leader, Tom Frieden, with simple use of aspirin, blood pressure control, cholesterol control, and anti-smoking work in this country. We could reduce some of the embarrassing levels of perinatal outcomes that exist in parts of our country, which don't need to be there for infants and children. That's the second aim, better care, better health for populations. The third aim is to do it all for less, lower cost through improvement, and that's the secret. I'm not talking about harming a hair on a single person's head. I'm not talking about withholding a particle of important care that people need. People deserve to and can have all the care they want and need when and how they want and need it. But through an agenda of improvement, we can achieve that at lower total costs for our society. We know what it can be done. That's the three-part goal that I feel properly represents the social need that the Affordable Care Act contemplates, that all of us do, no matter whether we're Medicare or another source of support for care for people. Better care, better health, and lower cost. We can and we will be very serious about this in Medicare. We can do a ton on all three of those. With respect to better care for individuals, I think we can focus our energies and will more and more on patient safety, for example, as a mainstay agenda for our country, joining the private sector everywhere we possibly can in pursuit of, finally, the reduction in injuries to patients that our country can achieve. The same goes for the reliability of effective care, for patient-centeredness. This is an agenda we have tools to play out through the Affordable Care Act and other policies in CMS. Rewards to hospitals that are able to get safer, advantages to Medicare Advantage plans that can demonstrate more patient-centeredness. We can align incentives much better than we ever have, and we can reach out with more help. If my back were to the wall, though, and I were to think of the one agenda that really can crack this nut, that can give us the care that Kevin designs, it is integration. It's being able to overcome this habit of fragmentation. It's at the root of a lot of the safety problems, but it's at the root of a lot of failure of us to achieve that overall agenda of better care, better health, and lower cost. And so let me mention three particular resources that lie within the Affordable Care Act that give me enormous hope about what we can accomplish in this country if we keep our heads straight. We have now a selection of new opportunities to foster and fund and reward care systems in this country that are able to now take responsibility for populations of patients, to think about care journeys. The simplest form is bundling payment in the new law, the ability to pay instead of for very separate events, but instead pay for episodes of care where everything that happens to a heart attack victim or to a stroke victim can be covered under a single payment. What that does is allow the caregivers much more flexibility in adjusting the care to what the individual patient needs. If they need a home visit, they can get it. If they need more counseling or education, they can get it. So that's one version of encouragement to integrated care. So are medical homes and health homes. These are forms that are now taking shape under the Affordable Care Act in which we can actually pay for the stewardship of the journeys of patients. But one of the most exciting forms of that is the so-called Accountable Care Organization, or ACO. The ACO is a lingo, but it refers to an opportunity that we can offer to the country for organizations to decide to take responsibility for panels of patients who use them frequently for their primary care. So at last, an organization will be able to say to Mrs. Jones, I've got your back. Wherever you go, hospital, to a laboratory, to an imaging facility, to a primary care office or a specialist, I know you're there. I can help you through this journey and help you orchestrate your care in the normal fee-for-service environment of Medicare Parts A and B. It's a brilliant idea to be able to encourage and then reward organizations that are willing to take that responsibility for Kevin over time and space, the accountable care organization. The notice of proposed rulemaking for this, our first stab at what those look like, is going to be out in mid-January, and anyone interested in that can look at that guess that we're making about what accountable care organizations should look like, feed it back to us, and when we finally arrive at a final rule that will issue in the early summer, it'll be a much better set of concepts about how to help the country adopt much more orchestrated forms of care. Not in a one-size-fits-all version. We'll have to customize the answer to integrated care for every single community. Communities have to have the opportunity to shape the care that they want to build for the Kevins who reside in those communities, be they rural or urban, they'll be different. Be their histories of already integrated care and those for whom it will be new, they'll be different. But that ability to foster the pluralism and the approach to better care, better health and lower cost everywhere in the country is one of the great opportunities in the Affordable Care Act. Now, within that, we have two other investments represented here by my colleagues Melanie Bella and Rick Gilfillan. Melanie heads what I will call the Center for Dual Eligibles. It has a longer name, which I won't bother you with, in the Affordable Care Act, but what it means is this. Dual eligibles. These are our neighbors, 9.2 million of them, who happen to qualify for both Medicare and Medicaid. And the way they get that is to have very special and very important health care and mental health needs. They're our most vulnerable neighbors. They are journeying through their lives with a burden of illness and disability that exceeds that of most of their other Americans. They need us very badly. They also cost a lot, $350 billion a year. 40% of the Medicaid budgets in states is being spent on that small population of dual eligibles, and we don't get it right for them. The fragmentation I told you about that plagued Kevin and that causes safety problems and effectiveness issues in our country is especially burdensome for these people as Medicare and Medicaid don't work well together, as we fail to support delivery of care organizations and systems that can take these people under their wings and help them stay home where they want to be instead of in hospitals, can help them go from institutional settings to their settings where they can live with their loved ones with proper support. The Center for Dual Eligibles is a tremendously interesting investment under Melanie's leadership to help us help states craft much, much better systems of care that will truly meet the needs of these particularly important neighbors of ours. It will foster forms of innovation and integrated care for these people that I think will break through totally new levels of excellence. And next to Melanie sits Rick Gilfillan. Rick is the head of the other gem in the Affordable Care Act, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, the Innovation Center. That's a big bet. That's $10 billion of investment by Congress over a 10-year period in fostering innovation in our country, exactly what we need. You don't make a pig fatter by weighing the pig. You do by changing the way you're taking care of your farm. And if we can invest as a country in helping all of the tremendous energies of innovation around the country surface, we're going to see better care, safer care, more integrated care, more investment in health surface all over the country. Rick and I are going to be seeing to it that investment is well used for the support of improvement of care throughout the nation. As this progress toward integrated care is made, I think we're going to see a rebirth of organizations in this country capable of creating journeys instead of fragments, organizations that will put the patient and the family at the center of care, that will honor the individual preferences and values and background and capacities that Kevin was asking for, organizations that will have memory about patients, not amnesia, where finally we won't have to repeat our story over and over again to the next person we see, where we'll be given advice about where to go in a proactive way, where we'll sense a sense of teamwork around us. We'll talk to each other. as Kevin was asking, we'll pay attention to handoffs as we move, as patients move and families move around the system. They'll feel handed over from one part of the system to the other instead of dropped in the gap between these fragmented organizations. We'll manage resources more carefully and respectfully so that we're continually reducing waste that erodes the ability to invest in not just in healthcare but in other things that we value as a commonwealth. We'll be able to make investments in real innovation to move the care to where the patient's need is instead of constantly asking the patient to accommodate to our systems whether they meet those needs or not. We'll see proactivity. We'll see outreach for people to help them stay healthy. Chronically ill people now able to stay home instead of bouncing back into the hospital with needless readmissions. And those of us who are well given advice and support to stay well. We'll be rich in data. Transparency will be the new regime. And it will be possible to know everywhere all the time what the state of the system is, its quality, its excellence along all the dimensions of excellence and its costs. We will be fostering a whole new level of innovation and exploiting, I think, to their full advantage, the modern technologies that can bring us much more of what we need from the care system that's supposed to help us. And I think it will invest in the pride and joy of the workforce. One of the great erosive characteristics in healthcare today is the demoralization of professions who are sometimes as confused and feel as battered by the fragmentation as the patients and families themselves do. It's time to end that because pride and joy as a nurse or doctor or healthcare manager or pharmacist or therapist depends on working in a system that's crafted to help you do exactly what you want to do, which is to meet the needs of the people that you came to serve. But all of this will involve change. There is no other way. And I think that CMS joins in partnership with those other many stewards of healthcare in our nation who are willing to shoulder the burden of finding the care system that can do better, the new one, the better one. That leads me to the final thought I'd like to share with you, the final word, really, if the key word of what I've told you so far is coordination, integration, seamlessness, journeys. The key word that I want to leave you with is a different one, and that's authenticity. Let me explain what I mean. Change is hard, but it's the only way to improvement. In this enormous industry, with so much invested in the status quo, there will be two voices of response to the social need for better care, better health, and lower costs through improvement. One will be authentic. They'll be the real partners, the ones who really want to work together, not just with CMS, but with everybody else to try to birth the kind of care Kevin was asking for as a mainstay for every single American, better care, better health, and lower cost through improvement together, authentic search for better. I call it a great national expedition. We don't know exactly how to do this, but we absolutely can find out together if that's what we intend. But the other voice, hopefully a minority, hopefully a small minority, is inauthentic. It's those who are so invested in the status quo that they're smart enough to grab the new words, accountable care organization, integrated care, medical home, but they will only use those words to cloak the current reality. They become cloaks for the status quo, and that's inauthentic. The partners I will seek from CMS, the partners those of you interested in better care will seek, are the authentic ones, the one for whom change is not just not just acknowledged as necessary, but welcomed, embraced, pursued for real, because in the end, that's what we want for ourselves and our families and our children and the children we will never meet. Better care, better health, and lower cost for all of us, all together. In that authentic search, you'll have no better partner than CMS and no more willing colleague than I. Thank you very much for the chance to share thoughts with you, and I look forward to your...
Our Our thanks to Dr. Donald Berwick. He's administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. I'm Sarah Varney. I'm the health reporter for KQED Public Radio and the California Report, and I'm going to be conducting the audience question portion of today's program, and we have many, many questions. We're going to be here all night long. There are a lot of questions here, obviously, with the federal judge's ruling yesterday in Virginia calling into question whether or not this provision to require people have insurance is constitutional or not. Could you speak about how you are sort of navigating what's going on inside CMS as the courts are considering whether or not major parts of this legislation are in fact able to move forward?
Yes, well, there have been something like 20 court rulings. You know, this is the only one that's gone this way. There are two other rulings on the merits which have found otherwise, and there have been 12 states that have not accepted the cases that have come before them. So I'm optimistic about where the courts will end up, and I think this law will withstand the court challenges. For me, the answer is easy right now. I have a great job and a wonderful chance to help America achieve the kind of health care it wants to be. And every day I go to work thinking about how will I help things be better for 100 million people? How will I protect the Medicare Trust Fund and make sure Medicaid is sustainable for the federal government and the states? And how can we help the whole country navigate toward better care? That's a plenty full-time job, and I'm doing it every single day as hard as I can.
Well, a follow-up to that, one of our audience members here wrote, the Republican leadership has characterized you as a socialist who's more interested in rationing care than creating market-based approaches and incentives for improving quality and reducing cost. And this person says that they know your work and that that's not true. And why have you not stood up and challenged that unfair characterization?
I've been very busy. I abhor rationing. I think it's unnecessary. I think the agenda we have to have as a caring and well-endowed nation is that every single person gets all the care they want and need exactly when and how they want and need it. That is achievable through the kind of pursuit of improvement I'm talking about. That's the dignified and important agenda. I am not in favor of rationing at all. And it's important to know rationing occurs in our country every day. Insurance companies who decide what will be covered or what not are making decisions about whether people have access to what they want and need. My own daughter needed a laboratory test a couple of years ago, I remember. I know she needs it. I'm a doctor. I understand that she needed the test, and the insurance company said, nope, it's not covered. No accountability, no way to ask them why not, who made the decision. I'm for transparency and not for rationing.
There's a lot of questions here, of course, about the baby boomers, the first of whom are going to be turning 65 starting in January. And this question is pretty blunt. With the baby boomers becoming the majority of the population, could this ultimately tank Medicare? It's ultimately about the financial longevity of Medicare.
Well, as you know, the Affordable Care Act has been scored for its ability to help protect the trust fund, which is one of my main duties, is to make sure that people who need Medicare now have it and that the people who will need Medicare long into the future will have it. So I have to think about stewardship all the time. The trustees report laid out the analysis of the Affordable Care Act, which one of its findings was that the Medicare trust fund, which would go bankrupt in 2017, is extended by 12 years just by that law right now till 2029. That's a lot of breathing room. And that's the whole point. We need to continue to navigate our country toward the kind of healthcare system that is sustainable, and that in my remarks bear heavily on that. I believe that an improved system organized around needs of patients, attending carefully to stewardship of safety and effectiveness and patient-centeredness, and building integrated care, especially for the chronically ill, will be far more sustainable than the one we have now.
If there was another question from an audience member, if there was one measure that you were trying to affect that would indicate improvement on the states, or on the status, rather, of U.S. healthcare, what would that be and why?
It's hard to have one measure. My ultimate measure of success is in the eyes of the people we serve. And so if I really were forced to think about it, I'd say I want to hear how the beneficiaries of Medicare and their families and loved ones feel their care is. And if they tell me, now you remember me, now you help me, now you help me through the journey, now it makes sense to me, then I think it's going to tell us we're very much on the right track.
And some questions about Medicaid as well. What are the changes CMS is advancing to improve and modernize Medicaid, which will be the coverage home for half of the 32 million people who will be covered under the Affordable Care Act's provisions?
Well, as you know, Medicaid is a state-federal partnership, and we have to have enormous respect for the individual states as they navigate their way to sustainable support of Medicaid in the forms that they choose, subject to the guidelines that we're required to make sure are honored in federal law. There's a tremendous amount in the Affordable Care Act that helps Medicaid get strengthened. It does extend coverage to populations of people who are not currently eligible for Medicaid, for example, single adults up to 133% of the poverty line. For every new covered individual in this law, the federal government provides 100% of the cost of that coverage for the next several years. It then tails down till 2020 to 90% and stays there. So there's a big federal stake in helping expansion of Medicaid coverage occur in a way that's sustainable for the states. We're helping the states smooth their enrollment processes for CHIP and Medicaid beneficiaries and those who will now be beneficiaries of the new exchanges that will be set up either by states or in partnership with the federal government. We have a 90-10 match right now. 90 cents out of every dollar that states are going to put into modernizing those enrollment systems is coming from the federal government. We're taking a closer look at quality of care under Medicaid, helping both beneficiaries and states know that the care that the Medicaid beneficiary is getting is improving steadily. So we're out to strengthen Medicaid. The states are under tremendous stress right now. We all know that. I hear it every place I go. I've been visiting every regional office, and every message I get is how difficult it is for the states. Now we're committed to helping the states navigate through this passage and get to a sustainable Medicaid system. You understand that a state that doesn't invest in that kind of coverage is going to pay the bill anyway because the people aren't going to go away. And when they arrive at the emergency room with the disease that could have been prevented or the complication of chronic illness that could have been intercepted, they're going to cost a lot. And by the way, most of that cost is going to be picked up by the state or by local people, not by the federal government. And so the partnership's crucial to us, and we're going to make it work.
And to that point, there's a question here about what's happened recently in Arizona with the liver transplants and a question about whether or not you plan to challenge the Arizona Medicaid program's refusal to cover liver transplants.
I don't think I'll comment on that right now.
You have the authority to even do that.
Right. I won't comment on that situation right now.
Okay.
Happy to leave.
Let me just remind our radio listeners that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today, we are speaking with Dr. Donald Berwick, Administrator, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Dr. Berwick is discussing the changes to Medicare and Medicaid under President Obama's Affordable Care Act. Another question here about the primary care physician shortage. I think we have a lot of nurses and doctors here today. The primary care physician shortage does not seem to be well addressed in the Affordable Care Act, nor does it adequately address the poor infrastructure in primary care clinics to provide high-quality care. Should Medicare reevaluate RBRVS, you're going to have to translate that for our radio audience, to place greater value on primary care?
RBRVS refers to the way that payment is calculated according to the resource-based relative value of the service, and it's a model that's currently used. But the question is quite right in some ways. Let me explain. It really doesn't matter how you go at meeting Kevin's needs, at understanding what an integrated, respectful care system looks like. You will find its roots in primary care. Primary care physicians, nurses, and others, but people who have a home base, some place they can go to that knows where they are, that knows what their journey is like, that can help them anticipate, that guide them through the sometimes very complex technical thicket. We are underinvested in primary care in this country. We know that in part because of the shortage of primary care physicians and other primary care providers now, which is growing rather serious. It becomes more serious in the wake of new people entering the system now with coverage who will want primary care, who otherwise wouldn't have the means to seek it. The Affordable Care Act actually has quite a bit in it that addresses this. There's a short-term fix in boosts in payment to primary care physicians for certain services over a two-year period. That helps. There's investment in the Affordable Care Act and other law for new investments in safety net systems, fairly qualified health centers, and primary care services for the neediest of our population. Parts of the legislation reflect a potential reallocation of residency training slots for physicians from specialties to primary care, which we now have the opportunity to do and will have more in the future. But we're not done. And everyone knows that part of the agenda for our country has got to be to boost the attractiveness and plausibility of serving in primary care capacity. It's one of the most rewarding professions one can have. I'm a primary care physician myself, and my own daughter is now training to be a primary care internist, I'm proud to say, and it is the place to be, if you ask me. But we have to keep working to make it more and more attractive. A modernized system, modernized with respect to its information architecture, which we're well underway for now, one that values and rewards integrated care, is going to be one much more willing to invest in primary care and able to do that, and it'll improve the well-being of the primary care providers of the country to work in an environment like that.
There's some additional questions here, additional workforce questions as well. This person must have heard you speak recently at the Future of Nursing event in Washington, D.C. And would you speak to needed changes and improvements in our country's healthcare workforce to improve health outcomes?
Yes. First, I'll mention the partnership in federal government around workforce issues. CMS has a big stake in that. We fund a lot of the graduate medical education, for example, but the HRSA, the Health Resource and Service Administration, is a leader in the federal government and workforce, and we're working very hard with Mary Wakefield and her colleagues there to think about the workforce. In fact, a new group is being stood up that I'll be part of to look at workforce planning for in HHS. The report on the future of nursing that's come out from the Institute of Medicine, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, as of a couple of weeks ago, is very interesting. It has a number of recommendations. I'm deep in studying those recommendations now, and with my colleagues in leadership of CMS, we're taking them all seriously and looking to see what we can do that will help build on the good thinking in that report.
There's a question here about who wins and who loses in all of this. Mm-hmm. Health reform and the drive toward greater efficiency and cost savings inevitably mean that someone somewhere is going to lose money. It seems this usually means hospitals, fairly or unfairly, if this person works for a hospital or not. is it possible that there are places where the system is as lean as possible and that the best option is shifting the existing investment into mechanisms that produce the outcomes we expect?
Well, that's a complicated question.
Yeah.
I'll start at the end of it. Okay. Yes, there are places, organizations, communities that can teach us a lot in this country. They have been able to navigate themselves into better care, better health, and lower cost better than the rest of us. Every one of them would tell us they themselves can do better. But the whole idea of finding out who's successful, featuring it, studying it, celebrating it, and helping that knowledge become a common good is very much the agenda of improvement that I seek. Will there be losers? Well, if we have an unsustainable healthcare system in this country, we are all losers. We won't want to deal with the crisis in our country of a healthcare system that simply cannot meet our needs. So in some larger sense, we can all be winners by having a sustainable system that can help us and our neighbors and our children the way we really want to be helped. I have a lot of faith in the ingenuity and the capacity of the leadership of the American healthcare systems of today, the hospitals, the clinics, the stakeholders that some thrive and some don't in the current status quo, to figure out that there's a new game in town and that it's important to migrate business plans and energies toward the world of integrated care, safer care, more effective care, and move their own model of business and opportunity to where the future lies. The smart organizations will do that, and they can win. And I don't see why they all can't if they're willing to modernize their approach and understand that the secret to success is meeting social need always. And the social need now is for better care, better health, and lower cost through improvement at the same time. I think we're going to see the plans of the healthcare system move in the direction that society needs. And everything I'm doing and the Affordable Care Act is organized to is to make that smart to do.
I think embedded in that question, though, is this idea that, you know, in California, certainly, there does not seem to be a link between how much you pay for care, certainly in a hospital, versus the quality of care that you get. So will Medicare move more towards that idea of only paying for the quality of care at some set, that you'll essentially have to choose some winners, essentially, who are doing a good job and others who are not?
There's a whole range of new consequences in the Affordable Care Act that are what I think as intelligent consumers of care we want. The question's absolutely right. In the current system, there's often very little linkage between the quality of care delivered and the amount that hospital or a physician gets paid. There's almost no relationship between outcome and payment. It would be you went out to buy a car or another product and you paid the same no matter how good it was.
I bought one of those cars.
I bet you did. But I think it's important for me to note, I do not in my heart believe that doctors and nurses and leaders in healthcare today want care to be bad. They want it to be good. But if the structure of incentive and payment doesn't really support the pursuit of continually better care, then you get less activity in that direction because people have other things that they are doing with their energies. In the Affordable Care Act, there are a list of things which I don't think I have the time to recite them all, but for example, value-based purchasing for hospitals, new ways to measure the performance of hospitals, to post them publicly on Hospital Compare so anybody in the country can go and compare hospitals to each other, and then link payment to the performance on that on those very well-crafted indicators. For Medicare Advantage plans, we now have a star rating system, 0 to 5 stars. And over the short term now, under the Affordable Care Act, there'll be bonus payments, quality bonus payments to organizations that move from 3 to 4 stars or 4 to 5 stars. That gets better. There is an overall theme in the Affordable Care Act and in the work of Medicare now, more and more to link what we pay to what we want. And that will help everyone not migrate to the kind of improvement we seek.
And there's quite a few questions here actually about payment policy. This one is, what role will or can CMS payment policy play in promoting appropriate care towards the end of life? And are you concerned about death panels? Facing one yourself, perhaps.
The needs of people with severe illness are extensive, and everything we do to build better coordinated care for them helps them at any phase in their journey through their illnesses. It'd be hard to overstate how much better we could be doing for people with these, in the periods of their lives when they really need us to be a team, to be with them, to be talking to each other, as Kevin asked for. Whether they're approaching the end of their life or whether they're simply living for a very long time with chronic illnesses, we can do so much better for those people and meet their needs every day, and that's what we're going to do.
And quite a few questions as well about the role of information technology.
Yes.
This question is, what role can IT and increased access to patient data play in the development of a sustainable healthcare system? Can this be achieved without unreasonable compromise of the integrity of patient privacy?
To the last, yes. Attention to privacy and honoring the needs of the privacy constituents, which is all of us, is very important. But given that constraint, I am absolutely thrilled by the possibilities that technology can bring to us. I can see, especially in rural settings now, the ability to project knowledge and assistance out to rural facilities that otherwise might not have access to that kind of expertise. The field is just burgeoning with possibilities. And I've been there. I've worked in settings where I practiced for 20 years as a pediatrician. It so happened that because I always worked in an integrated care system that had invested in modernization early on. This is back in, believe it or not, the 1970s. 1970s, not 18. It had an electronic record. So I always practiced with an electronic record. I never practiced for a significant period of my career without an electronic health record. That meant that I never saw a patient without the record available. When a lab test was done, I always had the lab test result when I saw the patient. If a specialist that I consulted had an opinion, that opinion was available to me as soon as that person entered in the computer. So I come out of that rather weird world where I can understand what modernized management of information. It was completely secure. The patients had access to their records. But it meant that the story around the patient, we could know, the patient and I, and we could really manage information in a way just to maximize access. We can do that for everyone. The work that's going on now with the leadership of the Office of the National Coordinator, David Blumenthal, who's doing a brilliant job to extend the possibility of modernization information architecture all over this country through regional extension centers, Beacon Community Grants, and others, is just one of the most exciting stories in the country right now. I know we're going to get there.
And, of course, you're here in Northern California, so you're in Kaiser country.
Yes.
And there's what you were just describing, there's a question here about asking your opinion of Kaiser Permanente's integrated healthcare delivery model.
It's one of the examples in the country of, at its best, integrated care of the type we want and need, where a team exists, the information architecture supports that, allows the team to be a team. There's investment in knowledge by patients about their own conditions and possibilities. A web of support being built with and around the patient. And there are many leading integrated care systems in this country that are doing that and can teach the rest of us a lot about how to do that.
And we have time for just a couple more questions. How can the private healthcare sector most effectively work with you and your agency?
Every way possible. I sort of knew this when I arrived in my job now, but this is all of us or it's none of us. We're all in this or it isn't going to happen. And I want to say that again. There is no way in the world that CMS alone or any other party alone can help our country get to the healthcare system that we all really, really want. better care, better health, lower cost through improvement. It's got to be done together. Think about a doctor who wants to be party to the improvement of care, but is, for example, subjected to measurements of performance that are heterogeneous. Three different insurers plus Medicare is coming at them with different demands, different requirements, different goals, different measurements. It drives them crazy, and you can understand why. If we can coordinate better around issues like measurement, like the structure of payment, so that we're defining the directionality the same together with the professions, we're all in this together. And let me make a comment about the professions. This is not care improvement in America being done to the professions at all. In that parade of people I commented on who are in my office are the leaders of the American professional community, physicians and nurses and therapists and pharmacists who come into me saying, how can I help? They want to be part of the change, and this is something that I feel so strongly that the improvements that we're going to achieve and the system we want will be done hand in hand with the professionals who really want to do as I always wanted to do, the best for my patient. It's all in, everybody together.
And then just finally, we have just a few moments left, but you mentioned that your goal is to improve health and that, of course, a big component of health are these social determinants of health, where we live, where we work,
yes,
where we play, where we learn. To what extent, what are some specific goals that you have at CMS or specific initiatives that you have at CMS that are going to try and address those issues?
Well, I've challenged us at CMS to think about four areas of goals in our strategic plan. The first is excellence in our own operations. You can't ask somebody else in the world to do something you're not doing yourself. So if we say we want a healthcare system that's patient-focused, we have to be patient-focused, person-focused. If we want efficiency, we have to be efficient. So there's a series of agendas for CMS is terrific, but an even better CMS that's doing its work the way it wants the world to behave. Gandhi said, you must be what you wish to see in the world, I think. And the same applies to us. And then three external goals. Better care for individuals, and I think there probably the lead issue is safety, working hard on safety. Better integrated care, especially for the chronically ill, the dual eligibles, the people who need us over time and space. But the third area is prevention, being serious about that. CMS is not the lead federal agency on this. That's not how we're structured. We have this marvelous Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and others in the federal government, Howard Koh, our terrific Assistant Secretary for Health, who are focused on prevention every day as their mainstay. What I'm telling to Tom Frieden, the head of CDC, and Howard Koh and others is, how can we help? What can we be partners in? In the Affordable Care Act, we have new investments in prevention, the wellness visits for beneficiaries, the new covered preventive services. Everyone can have a mammogram absolutely free of charge. But we also have to play well with others here. The areas that intrigue me now are the same as that would people in this audience. Obesity, a serious American epidemic. We've really got to get serious about avoidable cardiovascular disease through what Tom Frieden calls the ABCs I mentioned earlier. I think improving perinatal outcomes, especially in vulnerable populations. Smoking cessation is still a problem. We still have too much smoking in this country. That would be a list of things. And what I'm saying to Tom and Dr. Koh and others is, how can we help? And we will help.
To what extent, though, does CMS specifically look at issues of the built environment, where your clients essentially are living, and how whether or not where they're living, how they're getting around in their daily life contributes to their overall health?
Well, if we do as we intend to hold hospitals and managed care systems and nursing homes more and more accountable for the quality of care, they will look at the built environment, because the extent that the environment is affecting the outcomes of patients, which we will be more and more surveillant and caring about and more transparent about, they will attend to whatever the generators are of ill health and disability, and I'm sure that will be among them.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Berwick.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Dr. Donald Berwick. He's administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. This program has been generously underwritten by the California Healthcare Foundation. I'm Sarah Varney, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.